Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Brandon Thurston from Wrestlenomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rate plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to a special edition of Pollock and Thurston. Don't adjust your calendar. It is not Wednesday. It's Monday morning. Hello, Brandon.
Hello, John. How are you?
I'm doing well. We are here for a bonus edition of Pollock and Thurston, and we are going to be getting to an interview that Brandon and I recently conducted with a former WWF wrestler, Nick Kaniski, and
we did chatting this on about Friday. We should mention.
Yeah, for the purposes of the timeline, we spoke with him on Friday, and then we put out our story earlier today where Nick Kaniski, this was the first time he's publicly spoke about this, about being propositioned by a company official at the time, Terry Garvin, back in the 80s when he was with the company. And he was in the WWF from 1986 until 1987. So we thought that this would be the best way to lay this out, not just with a written story, but also so you can hear in his own words and adding, you know, his personal experience here, not only what he is alleging occurred, but also how he handled it, who he went to, and the circumstances around the culture at the time in WWF that he observed during the period that he was a regular member of the company.
And I think one of the big keys here that you'll hear in the interview is Nick Kaniski saying he went to Vince McMahon, told him about being harassed by Terry Garvin. And apparently Vince McMahon didn't do anything about it.
Yes. So in this interview, we are going to have Nick Kaniski's account of things. We also are going to hear an account from Vince McMahon in 1992. So this would have been several years removed from this incident in particular.
From 6 years later. Yeah.
In March of 1992, when the Ring Boy scandal was first making headlines and Vince McMahon was positioning himself from the get-go of learning about all this like everybody else's, like he had no idea what was going on here. So with all that said, I think it's best that we just immediately get to this interview with Nick Kaniski. And then Brandon and I are going to be coming back on the back end. We'll react to the interview and be speaking about the many issues that are brought up from Nick Kaniski here. So sit back. This is Nick Kaniski discussing his account of what went on during his time in the World Wrestling Federation.
It's about a 27-minute interview. So here we go.
Get into a lot of the heavier subject matter that we will. I just want to do a little background for some of our viewers and listeners out there about sort of your transition going from a very highly accomplished amateur wrestler into professional wrestling. Was that always an avenue that you saw through, you know, being raised by your father? Was professional wrestling always something you had in mind? And tell us a little bit about your introduction into the business.
Well, you know, my father being world's champion, he is also the NWA and AWA world champion. I grew up it. So people go, well, what was it like to have a famous father? I go, well, I've never had any other father, so I don't know. So that was our lifestyle. I lost my mother at a very young age, and my father raised me and my brother Kelly wrestled too. I never really thought anything else in my life. I just always wanted to be a wrestler. Now, my dad didn't really want us to be professional wrestlers, you know, because a very tough lifestyle, and only the, you know, when you're on the top, you may make a living. But it's he was not happy that I was getting into the wrestling business and didn't really support it. But that's something that I just wanted to do. That was going to be my lifelong dream. As soon as I got done university, I hopped in a car and drove down to Texas, and I started wrestling with my brother. And then I went down to San Antonio and wrestled there, then Portland, Oregon, then over to Japan and Louisiana, and then finally AWA, and finally ended up with the WWF at the time.
And what was the pressure like getting into the industry with a last name like Kaniski? I mean, was it, you know, you're carrying a lot of weight with that name in the industry at this time?
Because my dad didn't want me in it, like Fritz von Erich and my dad were tag team partners and they were good friends. I mean, my dad never even told Fritz that I was coming down to wrestle. He wouldn't help me get booked. He really didn't train me. Eric Froelich trained me.
Okay.
It was tough. I think in a way it hindrances me. And I think the only good thing, my dad was, he was pretty rough in the ring and pretty hard on guys. And I think they'd want to kind of pay it forward to me. But, you know, I was a national champion and I could go with the best of them. So they couldn't do too much in the ring with me if I didn't want them to.
And did your father come around to it? Did he eventually become accepting of it when he saw you, you know, going from territory to territory? Or was it always like a bit of friction there about going this path?
No, he would never come. Say if I wrestled in Vancouver, he would never come watch me wrestle. As an amateur, he'd go all everywhere to follow me wrestle. But once I started turning professional, he did. I got the opportunity to wrestle with him a couple times, once in Corpus Christi. And then once in San Antonio, I believe it was Dory Funk Jr. And I forget Mike. Anyway, my dad and I got to do a tag team together. So that was fun. But he comes from a different era than wrestling is nowadays, you know. And I was kind of old school, you know. I think that kind of hurt me. It's hard to transition from an amateur to a professional. I think Kurt Angle did it excellent. I think Brock Lesnar did an excellent job at going there, but it's hard because it kind of goes against what you were trained for.
I'm always kind of curious about what training was like in a prior era. Cause I did some indie wrestling and I did train people too in the last, you know, 5-10 years or so. And I'm just curious, like what the training environment was like for you when you were learning how to wrestle for the first time?
You know, I was it's completely different. You know, I guess I play football too. And it's like when you go to 2-a-days on football, you're all black and blue. It's cold out there. You're getting beat up. In a wrestling room, it's always warm. You're sore, you know, you're better conditioned. And when I started, coming off the national team, going into professional wrestling, I mean, I was in good shape. I always kept myself in good shape. But I mean, just me hitting the ropes, I would be black and blue from here to there. You know, people would say it's fake. I mean, at the time, they were boxing rings. The rings were so hard. Let me slam you, you'd be urinating blood the next day. I mean, it hurts. And I mean, the people don't realize that, oh, it's fake. Maybe it's predetermined. But when you get slammed on concrete, you get slammed in the rings. When I went to the WWF, it was all the rings were so much better than, say, different rings I wrestled in. Some of them were hard. So, you know, I guess the old style is watching my dad wrestle Luthez. You know, there was a lot more wrestling. Well, it's physically impossible to be getting slammed off the top rope. The turnbuckles were hard. I mean, it's changed a lot over the years.
And you were in some territories that, I mean, you were putting like a lot of miles in between cities. And I think that part sometimes gets overlooked is just the amount of travel that we're talking about in that era as well by car.
Excuse me. Yes, there's two things about it, right? It is the actual wrestling part was probably the easiest part of it all. The traveling was hard. And I should say more people there, the easier it was to wrestle. You know, as you travel 300 miles and you get in a ring and there's only 30 people watching you wrestle. Like, oh my God, you know, I don't know how I could do that stuff, but you're in front of 60,000 people. You think you're a Hercules, you know, you just do it. But yeah, when you travel a long ways and you get a $50 payoff and there's only 30 people there at the matches to watch you wrestle, but the show's got to go on because sometimes I wrestled when there's 30 people and next week I come back and there's 2,000 people. So you never know, right?
So Brandon has put together your career record here. So if we need any help with the timeline, we do have a pretty much like an outline here. So we're going to go about a year and a half into your career. And this is when you go to the World Wrestling Federation. And can you tell us about the process of getting into New York and how that relationship came together and making the move over there?
Yeah, I came back from Japan and then I was wrestling in Hawaii. And then I got a call from the office from, I forget who from, and a contract that I go to the WWF. So I go into the fly in and start out. They didn't give me a big push, but I got going Madison Square Gardens, and I had a match against
Les Thornton.
He used to manage Kamala. Man, you're going
Steve
back
Lombardi?
A long ways. Yeah, Steve Lombardi. And we had a great match. They put me over, and Dave Meltzer said that was one of the best matches of the night there, Nick Kaniski wrestling Lombardi, and they gave me a good push. The announcer said that a possible future world champion, and they were good. On the spot shows, they usually put me over. Sometimes on TV, I'd get to do my stuff, and I'd tag off to another wrestler, and they'd beat the hell out of him and pin him, and that was it. And then I got put over, and then Ray, a booker, came up to me and said, hey, they want to give you a push and would like you to lose. I was probably about 270. You know, they would say, get down to about 255, 260. You're a little too big. You know, you got a little baby fat on you, I guess. And so I did. And, yeah, my career was going good. I was traveling. I was enjoying it. I that's all I ever wanted to do in life. You know, you go out there. I was on a card a lot with Hulk Hogan. So there were sellouts, you know, and there's nothing like, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50,000 people cheering your name. It's an unbelievable adrenaline rush. Mm-hmm.
And what was the difference being on like a card headlined by Hogan at the time versus like your like one of the other like they're running like 2 to 3 shows per night? How big of a difference would that be for like a big show with Hogan on top?
Well, when he was hot, you know, and so it was always a sellout when he was there, right? So when I was on the card, so it was always a sellout. So it was great.
And tell us, so when you are getting to shows, I mean, just describe for everybody sort of who are the key people in power at this point in terms of at the live events that you're maybe checking in with, going over the match, the finish, what is asked of you, like who are the people that are the go-tos?
Well, in WWE, they call them road agents. So they're retired wrestlers, or some of them could still actually wrestle and fill in. So make sure you're on time, you weren't late. They would tell you, you know, the finish, who's gonna, what are you guys gonna do? And they were your bosses. They kind of kept control. You know, we'd go on a road for months at a time, none of this 150 days and then time off. I mean, we'd go, you know, year around. So you'd run out of money. So you'd have to go to them and get cash, you know, from then if you wanted an advance or if you had any problems, you would talk to them, but they were our bosses.
So who were some of those people at that time who were working as road agents when you were there?
Pat Patterson, Terry Garvin, Jay Strongbow, Rene
Goulet,
he was a great guy to me. I just want that to be noted that he treated me very well. I got to wrestle with him. He back suplex was my finish. He says it was great. And he was the one who said they were going to give me a push and lose some weight. And I, you know, a month down the line, he says, I don't know what's happening, Nick. And 2 months. And he said, I would have never told you, but that's what they told me, the office, that they're going to give you a push and see how it goes. And it never really happened.
And what were some of the theories you had on what was affecting this push for you and just running into issues?
Well, there was he was high up in office and he was one of the managers, a guy named Terry Garvin. And he would come up to me and hit on me. And I mean, specifically one of the things, and I won't say what he said, but you'll understand the meaning behind it. He says, hey, Nick, let me perform oral sex on you. You can read a Playboy, and you'll have it made for life. And, you know, he is my boss. He controls my boss. This is my livelihood, what I want to do. And, you know, I kind of joked with him and I said, hey, Terry, you know, I'm not that way. And, you know, but if I ever change, you'll be the first. I'll let you be the first to know. Just kind of laughed it off that, but he was always kind of coming up and joking. And one time he came in my hotel room late at night and I told him to leave, you know, knocked at the door. So it put me in a very awkward position, you know. And, you know, why am I talking about this now? I've kind of talked to about before, but I don't think it would have got any traction, you know. And I just don't want any young people who are in, especially the wrestling business or any business work where you know, they get a pro quo or this happens to them. I think it shouldn't be in the workplace.
And you definitely felt that what he was offering, he was trying to get a sexual favor in exchange for, you know, better treatment in WWF.
There's no doubt about it. You know, hey, if you let me do this, you'll have it made for life financially. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no other way to take that.
Was this a pretty, like, certainly, you know, we look back and this very much is consistent with the reputation of Terry Garvin. Was this known at the time that Terry Garvin would do this type of thing? Was this chatter amongst the locker room in terms of Terry Garvin's actions, or did this catch you by surprise when he made these propositions?
I mean, it was just the norm. You know, it was so normal that guys didn't even really think about it. That's how I understood it, you know. And I can't remember when dates, you know, we're going back 39 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, I've been rooming with guys and on the phone and they said, Terry, you promised me, if I let you do this to me, you promised me you're going to give me more money or you're going to let me wrestle. And I could hear this on the phone with them arguing over the phone. Did I ever see anything with any other wrestlers or anything? No, but I mean, believe me, there was a lot of good looking young men in there. And I wasn't the only one being hit on.
And this was more than once that it happened to you, with at least with Terry Garvin, that it was, it sounds like, yes. It was at the venue and then also at the hotel.
Yes.
And when you're trying to process this, like, here is my career that is in this person's hands, someone that carries a lot of influence in this company, what is your response? Are you sharing this with anybody at the time?
Yeah. I talked to my dad about it, you know, and you got to protect yourself, you know, I was young. I was impressionable at that age. Man, I just wanted to be a professional wrestler. Leave me alone. I'm not that way. You know, I just do my business. If you don't think I can make it as a wrestler, that's one thing, but don't try to have a sex with me and then give me a push. Right. It's not fair.
And did you tell anybody, like the other road agents or anybody in charge about what had happened to you with Terry Garvin?
So I remember where it was. It was in Milwaukee, Oregon. We wrestled in Portland. I called Vince and I said, "Hey, Vince, you know, I don't think this is right. Terry's hitting on me. I don't appreciate that, and I would like it to stop." And Vince said, "Oh, okay, I'll deal with it." And that was it.
And was there did Vince do anything that you're aware of to talk to Terry Carvin or do anything to respond to what you told him?
No, nothing changed. You know, he'd still say, "Hey, have you thought about my proposition?" You know, as he walks by in the dressing room. So then what happened was, you know, I'm waiting to get this push, see what's happening. I was wrestling, I think we're doing TV and don't quote me on all these dates. Like I say, it's, you know,
this is a long time we're talking about.
Yeah. As we're, it was great because it was staying at the Amfact Hotel in, LA. And we're there for 3 days. And when you're wrestling, you're usually in a hotel room every night, a different hotel room. So if you get to stay in a hotel room for 3 nights in a row, that's like a day off, right? And so I wrestled the Friday, maybe a spot show somewhere around LA. I don't remember. And then LA was Saturday or that night. And they gave it off to me. Now, I still have all the expenses, and that would have been a good payday. Hogan was there. It was sold out. Probably Cow Palace, I believe, or I don't know, forget where we wrestled. I think, geez, they got plans for me. They give me a night off. It's a big payday. I don't get paid, and it's still paying for my hotel and food and everything. I go, well, that's great. They don't have plans. And then they came in, and I wrestled Randy Savage, and I put him over. Still no push. And I see they want me to do put someone else over. And I said, I thought Vince, I said, this isn't right, Vince. You know, I complain and now you guys are punishing me. And I go, I'll finish my bookings, but, I'm not putting any guys over. Put me in a ring. We'll see what happens. And Vince knows I can take care of myself. So he said, no. He said, then I said, I'm done. I said, I'll finish my matches. Nope, you're done now. I said, well, thank you very much. And I walked back, and I believe Brett was there. And I said, hey, Brett, I just quit. He goes, wow, I can't believe you quit. I said, I can't. You know, they can beat you, but they're not going to take my dignity from me. And I remember personally walking out with my Halberton bag on. This was my lifelong dream. I know I was done because Vince at the time had the only promotion. There was no other place for me to wrestle to make a living. You know, there's my, what I always wanted to do. My dreams are gone. But when I was walking out, I looked at all the wrestlers and you know, it gave me some self-pride. You know, it made me feel good that you can't take my dignity. I can hold my head up. You guys can't. You know, to live that kind of lifestyle and put up with that and be treated that way. You know, I'm just so happy now that the guys are making money and they got some protection. They got some time off. I mean, it's changed, but it was a dog-eat-dog world when I was wrestling back in the days. I forget who said it. Inmates taking care of the asylum. You know, we didn't have any control like all other promotions. It was the wrestlers, you know. So, yeah, it was a crazy business. I don't think people realized how crazy a business it was.
And you feel you were treated differently in the booking after rejecting Terry Garvin.
For sure.
And then that's what led to you to talk to Vincent about leaving.
Yeah. Well, I talked to Vince. I just wanted to stop. But after it didn't stop, and then they're, you know, trying to make an example out of me, you know, like, nah, I ain't going to do that, you know. So, I walked out, went back to the Amfact, called my dad, hopped on a plane, and he picked me up and then didn't know what to do and got in a restaurant bar business and had some of the two of the biggest bars in Washington at one time. They were rocking and it's down to one. And anyone's ever in Point Roberts, Washington, stop by Kaniski's Reef. It's on the water, a beautiful place to see. And if you guys come out, I'd even buy you a beer.
Okay, we'll hold you to that.
Yeah, a few beers. How's that?
A few years after you leave the WWF, that is when the Ring Boy scandal occurs, and there are the resignations of Terry Garvin and Pat Patterson. They also stop working with a ring announcer by the name of Mel Phillips. Were you detached from the industry at this point? Were you aware when that news happened in 1992? And was it at all shocking to you that finally there was a spotlight on what had been just this open secret that had been going on for years?
You know, after I got out of wrestling, I didn't even follow it, right? You know, just in the last few years, James Sabelski is a good friend of mine. He's an announcer. He follows wrestling. He probably knows more about wrestling than I do. And so that's how I know you guys. It was out in the scuttlebutt that what happened to me, and people would call and want to interview me and stuff. But, you know, I didn't want to be like, hey, I had sour grapes and I'm just mad, you know, so I didn't really want to be interviewed. Vince was very strong individual, very well spoken, you know, and a lot of money to back him. So I just, you know, I just moved on with my life. I was super busy in the restaurant business and just moved on with my life. Didn't really follow it. Didn't watch it. Didn't, you know, can you imagine a lot of people want to come in and talk about it in the restaurant? Well, the less I knew, the less I could talk about it because I got tired of talking about it all the time. You know, there's other things to talk about. But lately, you know, I started watching again different videos and, you know, watching podcasts and stuff. And no, I wasn't really aware of that. You know, I heard little rumblings about that, but it doesn't surprise me one bit. My understanding that they changed positions with them, but Terry Garvin came back eventually.
Terry Garvin never came back. Pat Patterson did. But Terry Garvin, they never worked with again. And he was pretty much just out of the industry completely until he died a few years after that.
Yeah.
Of course, this had a lot of media attention at the time, and we just wanted to play a short clip for you. This is about 30 seconds or so. This is when Vince McMahon was on Larry King Live. This was March 13th of 1992, and I just want to let you hear this and get your reaction. So here's Vince McMahon from 1992.
No one has gone to a police agency and said I was forced to have sex.
No one has filed one single charge, not one single charge with the police, with anyone.
Concerning sexual harassment.
Concerning sexual
harassment. Have you ever heard rumors of it?
No. I mean, these are things that you don't hear rumors of sexual harassment.
You wouldn't hear that?
Well, wait, if in fact you have someone who may be gay, then sure, you're going to hear locker room horseplay. That's going to happen. But just that. Anyone can always come to me. They've always been able to come to me and tell me if anything is out of line.
So
if anything
is out of line, any of your wrestlers could have come to you and said, there's a guy in the office coming on with me.
Absolutely. Notwithstanding the fact that I would not have wanted to have been that guy because any of my wrestlers would have broken his neck. I mean, you just don't do things like that.
So again, that was Vince McMahon in 1992 stating that anyone could come to me. And Vince is, you know, pleading ignorance here. And the way that, you know, just reporting that has come out over the time, there's certainly belief now that he was aware of the issues with Mel Phillips when he fired him in 1988 and then shortly after rehired him. And I mean, you have, you know, in your case, Nick, you went right to Vince McMahon. And I mean, he at this time in 1992 is stating like he's hearing about this stuff for the first time.
Yeah, I can only tell my story. And I from excuse me, from Milwaukee, Oregon. I remember at the hotel there, I called Vince and put a complaint in about Terry Garvin.
Well, we wanted just to play that clip for you as well. It seems that, you know, do you look back at your time in professional wrestling and is this something that clouds it for you? Or do you still have some, you know, fond memories of your time in the industry?
You know, I try to stay positive. You know, I was probably lucky to get out of the industry. You know, it's a hard lifestyle. You know, I'm very successful. You know, I got to be a fire chief. I've got to be, you know, owner of the bars. Life's been very good to me. I got a place in Palm Springs, Arizona. I get to travel. So I was probably lucky I got out of the business because I would probably be, you know, beat up in a wheelchair. It's just not a good lifestyle.
I just want to mention, I think it's important that there are more people, like we saw Paul Roma on News Nation several days ago come out with a story about, you know, things that he was aware of. But I think it gives people reassurance that, you know, that people are going to kind of back them up to say that I had a similar experience.
You know, and I saw that interview, right? And I think that's what really made me, you know, if Paul would come out and talk, I'm sure he was hassled. And I think, you know, I should get out and say something. So hopefully this never happens again.
It's, I think it's really important, Nick, that, you know, people, it's very tough to come out and talk about these things publicly, but this is an industry that has gotten away with a lot is just kept quiet. You don't talk about stuff that goes on behind closed doors. And here we are all these years later, and these scandals keep popping up. I think it's very important that people come out and share these stories. So I want to thank you very much, not just for being open, but also, you know, having the trust to come on and speak with us about what I'm sure is not the most easy topic to discuss.
Yeah, it's life, and it was part of my life, and I walked away with in a very awkward situation. You know, they didn't take my pride from me. You know, I felt I never did anything wrong, and it worked out very well for me. I just feel very sorry for the people it didn't work out for, and hopefully it never happens again.
Well, we want to thank you very much, Nick, for joining Brandon and myself, and we will definitely take you up on that offer for several beers when we connect.
John and Brandon, thank you very much for having me on your great podcast. May the best things that happen to me be the worst things that happen to you, and you guys have a great day. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Speaking with Brandon Thurston and I from this past Friday. So again, we want to thank Nick very much for joining us. A lot of takeaways from that, Brandon, re-listening to it just now on top of it. Your key points that are brought up is that during his time there, he was informed by Rene Goulet, listen, cut some pounds. The office has plans for you. And he outlined, you know, comments that were made by Terry Garvin, who we should put into context here. He was an official with the company. He was at a point a booking assistant to Pat Patterson, would have had an office role in the company. And allegedly, according to Nick, that he was flat out propositioned by Terry Garvin, stating that, listen, you will, if you go ahead with this, you'll be made in this company, in essence. And Nick Kaniski turned down this advance and went to Vince McMahon, issued a complaint, and the comments did not stop. Terry Garvin was not in any way admonished for this, continued working with the company. And then, you know, Nick started to see like a change in how the company was booking him and ultimately left the company. And Terry Garvin continued to work with the WWF until the resignations in early 1992. And Garvin never came back to the company. He died of stomach cancer in 1998, but that was pretty much the end of him in the industry. And I think that it does outline, you know, other reports that we have seen in terms of the key individuals involved in this. Like, we go back to 1988 and what David Bixenspan uncovered when he wrote that Business Insider article, that Mel Phillips was fired once in 1998 due to, you know, his unnatural relationships with young boys, and then rehired by the company with the provision that he steer clear of the ring boys. And continued with the company up until 1992 when they stopped working with him in the midst of the Ring Boy scandal. Like, it does, this is not just something where it is solely on the person that was propositioning talent, but the fact that this went to the very top and were examples of complaints and that went unheard.
And just to catch people up, so Terry Garvin is not the first allegation of sexual harassment against Terry Garvin. I know there's an allegation from Barry Orton. Is that correct?
Yes.
And there's allegations that Terry Garvin was involved with the Ring Boy scandal in terms of, would it be harassing or also assaulting the Ring Boys?
Well, in the Barry Orton case was when Terry Garvin was a booker in the Amarillo territory. And Barry Orton has stated in both, it was on John Arezzi's show, later with Slam Wrestling, that he was in the car and that Terry Garvin was repeatedly propositioning him to perform oral sex on Barry Orton, who turned him down repeatedly. But it was a very uncomfortable 6-hour car ride that the two were having. And it seemed like Garvin was just relentless here. And Barry Orton felt that, you know, when he got to the WWF, that the fact that he turned that down those advances all the way back in 1978, that there was, you know, here is somebody that is in a power position in WWF. You also had Tom Cole, who stated that in his issue that he had instances with Terry Garvin, including one where he was brought to Garvin's home and ended up sleeping out in a vehicle outside of Garvin's home, not wanting to be in there with him. And the following day, Tom Cole finding out he's been fired by the company in February of 1990. And it relayed to Tom Cole that it was Garvin's call to fire him.
Right. And I think one of the biggest takeaways we have here is we know that Vince goes on Larry King in 1992 and says that he's never even heard rumors of any kind of sexual harassment or sexual misconduct within the company. And we have Nick Kaniski telling us that in 1986 or 87, he talked to Vince and Vince did nothing.
And a failure on Larry King in the sense of an easy like follow-up that was extremely glaring in listening to those clips is that when Vince McMahon pauses and states no, also adding the caveat, well, if someone is gay and you hear about horseplay in the locker room, sure. Please define horseplay. Like what was horseplay that was going on that made its way to your, onto your desk? How did you hear about this? And what exactly are you alluding to when it comes to horseplay and who did that involve as well?
And to put this timeline in context, I know you've done some research to try to place where these incidents happened. If we put this in context to think about, you know, Rita Chatterton's allegation of being sexually assaulted by Vince McMahon in a limousine, that's July 1986. So that is actually before this. You've got allegedly Vince McMahon being involved in a rape already at this point when Nick Kaniski tells him that he's being sexually harassed. It gives you some idea of whether or not Vince really did take this seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. That like this is in, you know, fairly close proximity to that as well. And yeah, we've tried to piece this together. And obviously we are talking 37 years ago, that this occurred. And I mean, we cannot like lock down the dates of where this happened. And when you heard from Nick there, like he believed that he had wrestled somewhere in, I think it was Los Angeles, in and around that area, but he outlines a Friday night show that he works. And then the Saturday he is set for a show. He threw out the idea it could have been the Cow Palace as a possibility and is taken off of a show and therefore, you know, doesn't get a payoff for a Saturday night show. And while we couldn't link up those cities, what I was able to find on the history of WWE site is that right at the end of his run, he does work a Friday night show in Landover, Maryland. And then the next night, he is advertised to take on Mike Sharp at Maple Leaf Gardens in Toronto, which would be an A-list city for them. And it's removed, does not take place. And then he ends up wrestling one more match with the company just days later on May the 20th against Ron Bass. And then his next advertised date is May 23rd in Hartford. That match does not take place as advertised, and he never wrestles for the company again. So, I mean, I look at that. Again, we can't lock that down, as this is the timeline of when all of this occurred. But it does link up with his description of a Friday, Saturday set of dates. And then if you are to look at it of him eventually, you know, giving his notice and Vince McMahon telling him you can be done now, that would link up with the ending there.
Yeah. And I think it's encouraging to hear him say at the end that, you know, he feels like he preserved his integrity. He didn't do anything that he was coerced into, and he chose to just leave the company rather than deal with that. For anybody that might be wondering, I guess, why we're doing this now and how it connects to today, what would you say, John, to somebody who's sort of questioning it? Why are you digging this up from 37 years ago today in light of the news that's coming out of late, including the Janelle Grant lawsuit against WWE, Vince McMahon, and John Laurinaitis?
As we've dedicated so much time and effort to this story, yes, the Janelle Grant lawsuit is what has spurred on so much of this. But to me, this is a much larger picture we are trying to paint, that this is something that we can look at instead of these random isolated incidents, whether it is Nick Kaniski or Rita Chatterton or the Ring Boy scandal or Ashley Massaro or Janelle Grant. All of this is under a system. And to me, it starts at the top with Vince McMahon, that there is a culture that is prevalent throughout decades of this company, that there are stories of knowledge right at the very top where action was not taking place. And I think that you have to only apply this culture to what you read in this Janelle Grant lawsuit. All of this was shrouded in secrecy and silence and NDAs, that I think we are painting a much broader picture of a company that there was knowledge of this that went unchecked for decades. And this is just another example of it.
And I would add that there are parallels in the sense that Janelle Grant's complaint alleges that multiple WWE executives who are not Vince had knowledge of the abuse that she alleges was occurring by Vince McMahon and John Laurinaitis, that they had knowledge and nothing was done to intervene. So we'll see how that plays out, but it's similar to Vince allegedly having knowledge of sexual misconduct that was happening back in the 80s, as early as then.
And I don't know if this is going to be some, you know, large outpouring of different stories coming forward or not, but it was really telling in the interview, Brandon, that the thing that gave Nick the push to talk about this was just hearing the Paul Roma clip from last week, which was a story that had been out there, but revisited by Ashley Banfield, and just seeing that. And there is a power in numbers when people are coming out and talking about these stories for the first time in an industry that is, you are so pushed towards, you don't snitch. You don't talk about the inner workings of the industry. What goes on behind closed doors stays behind there. And having that ability to go forward, this was a case of someone that was incentivized in the sense that hearing another story, they wanted to get their story out with the hope that, you know, maybe it spurs on others, that this does not happen again to anybody else. And I think that there is a real powerful message there in terms of, you know, one person comes forward and does that encourage others to share their own experiences that are out there. We have an example here in Nick Kaniski, this guy deciding to speak publicly about this for the first time.
Yeah, and I think that sense of not wanting to say anything or do anything that's going to hurt the business or hurt WWE was well articulated in I think this is a recent interview that Dawn Marie did. I don't know if you saw these comments where she talks about why she didn't, you know, come out with this, some of her complaints, including, you know, WWE releasing her in 2005 when she was pregnant. And she explains it in the sense that she didn't want to come out and, you know, say bad things about the business and hurt the business because in the sense that the business has done so much for me, how dare I go out and do something that hurts the business, which I think is just, you know, a totally wrongheaded mentality to have. And I don't know that she has that mentality now, but that
it underscores the institution that has been built in terms of how this is viewed by those that are occupying this industry, that work in it. Like, this is something that is bred into people of, you do not attack the business. You do not break down the business. And I mean, I'm not making comparisons of like other stories, but I mean, you can look at, you know, the church being an institution, that it was that same kind of thinking in that you don't speak out against the church and look at the reporting that went into that from the Boston Globe over 2 decades ago.
Yeah, I would say nobody's under an obligation to come forward with their story about, you know, abuse and trauma. And I think that yet on the other hand, you're not doing something to hurt this institution or this organization. You're doing something that should improve it, improve the treatment of people and prevent people from being harmed in the future.
That's exactly it. It's like no one is pushing anyone to, you know, have to relive what could be the most traumatic events of their entire lives. But if the reason is just preservation of this industry as though you are owing to it, it is, I think, the health of the industry that this is uncovered and significant changes are made so that this is never something that is happening again, even if we are talking about instances from 3 decades ago. But you can look in the case of Janelle Grant that none of those situations should ever be occurring either. And those are much more recent and happening within this modern age, as much as you would look at, well, the industry is not the same as it was in the 80s. That stuff isn't going on now. Yeah, but there are plenty of other issues that you can read in that 67-page lawsuit by Janelle Grant that is modern.
Absolutely.
So anyway, that was our full interview with Nick Koniski. Again, we want to thank him very much for joining us. We're going to be back on Wednesday speaking about a pair of subjects because TKO is going to be having their earnings call on Tuesday evening. Nothing like an evening earnings call to hear. Are you expecting the same format of Ari Emanuel, Mark Shapiro as the representatives on this call?
I am. I think it's going to be maybe a little bit more insight on W Business, but not a lot than we got last time. I think last time it was the case that the merged company had only really existed with both entities inside of the holding company for about 2 weeks. This will be an entire quarter. But I think we're going to get four segments for UFC, four segments for WWE. I think there's some interesting questions to be asked. I'd be very curious around this subject, whether any of the analysts on the Q&A do ask Ari Emanuel or Mark Shapiro anything about why Vince was brought back to the company. You know, how did they do due diligence? How much did they really do to look into what the allegations were around Vince, et cetera? And there's a question.
What's the state of his stock? Is he right? Is there any ability for TKO to request him to divest of stock? Will he remain still the largest single largest shareholder?
And I've brought this point up a lot of times. Stock analysts are interested in estimating the value of this company. What should the stock price? What is the appropriate stock price for this company? That is their ultimate objective. Mm-hmm. And it's not always to be a journalist and ask questions that we think should be asked. So I will not be surprised if there's minimal conversation around this, given that some of the equity analyst reports that we've seen so far don't mention this scandal around Vince really at all. So we'll see what happens there. Another thing I'm interested to see if they give us any news about is what's going to happen in Q4 of this year when Raw's deal with USA Network has expired.
That's right.
And there's going to be a October, November, December where where's Raw going to air and before it goes to Netflix in January.
So that will be coming up this Wednesday. We'll spend the first half of the show talking about the earnings call, what is said, what is not said. And then on the back half of the show, I'm looking forward to this conversation. We're going to be welcoming in John Arezzi, who was the host of the Pro Wrestling Spotlight show that was doing all of this coverage over 3 decades ago when the Ring Boy scandal was breaking. And I mean, his show was a very influential one when it came to the amount of names that he was having on. A lot of these stories were beginning on his show of people coming forward, speaking on the record. And, you know, he has written about it in his book. And he has a very unique experience in that he first met Mel Phillips in the early 70s at a fan convention. And they were, you know, they were two of the regulars at a lot of the garden shows. So he was friendly with Mel Phillips before the knowledge of all of the allegations against Mel Phillips would come to light. So, I mean, he has it from that perspective of covering the story with probably a deeper knowledge or at least a relationship with Mel Phillips than most had in that early 90s period. So I think that this is going to be a really enlightening conversation with John and how it contrasts to today that here we are all these years later and looking at a fresh set of scandals on top of it.
And that, as always, is on Wednesday at 3. And the ironic point I pointed out to you last night, I was going through some of Nick Kaniski's matches, including the two, you know, well, better known matches he had with Randy Savage, and Mel Phillips is actually the ring announcer for one of those matches. So what do you know?
Before we end off, is there anything you wanted to share about Anthony Gaines? He was a Buffalo area independent wrestler who died very tragically over the weekend at the age of 30. I know that, you know, obviously very heavily part of the same scene as you. It was just a very unfortunate story, not someone I was too familiar with, but I would imagine most would have seen the very viral clip that he was involved in, Ace Romero back in 2018, which just got circulated everywhere of him taking this incredible pounce out of the ring.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's really shocking and sad. I mean, there were a lot of people in our independent wrestling scene who were close with him, and it's just, you know, we don't know what would happen, but you know, it's really sad. I would say he's one of the generation of guys that I think came through sort of helping out at ESW and helping with ring crew when I was, I don't know, maybe in my earlier 30s or late 20s or so, when it did feel like there was like another generation of local independent wrestling talent coming up. And, you know, he was always a very outspoken person. And, you know, like we would go, everybody would get together and like go out to eat afterwards. And he would always be, you know, yelling up a storm or something like that. And I remember making a comment to him once, like, you'd make a great manager. And he was pissed to hear me say that. So like he wanted to be a wrestler. And like, I totally underestimated him, and he very much, became a wrestler, you know, far beyond what I could, far beyond what I imagined he was capable of. And he did very well for himself as a wrestler, for sure.
So just want to send our condolences to friends, family as well of Anthony Gaines, who passed away at the age of 30. So that's going to do it for today's special edition of the show. Thank you to everybody for tuning in on this Monday show. Again, we're back on Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern time. You can also catch up on your WrestleNomics listening from Sunday with a rundown of all things going on in the world of professional wrestling with one Brandon Thurston at patreon.com/WrestleNomics. I'm back tonight with Wei Ting on the Post Wrestling YouTube channel with Rewind to Raw. So we will speak with you then. And coming up Wednesday, John Arezzi joins Pollock and Thurston.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health, or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.